This is Teresa Caraggio with Third Paradigm, presenting an interview with Nicolette Hahn Nyman. She was the environmental lawyer under Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who headed up his hog campaign to take on big ag and factory farming. She's a regular speaker at environmental conferences and food events. She's now married to the founder of Nyman Ranch and has become a rancher in Northern California. Her informative and highly readable book, Righteous Pork Chop, shows her intrepid investigation into big business animal farms and the devastating effect on both the animals and on water and air pollution. The following interview, however, focuses on her new role, where she's directly involved in animal husbandry, and picks up in some places where the book leaves off.
First, I wanted to say, Nicolette, that I really appreciated both aspects of the book, because personally, I'm a data junkie. I actually get a thrill out of spreadsheets. And so your book was so full of facts and just hard data, but it made it palatable because you had so many personal anecdotes in there. And so I wanted to thank you for that, because it is really a very pleasurable read, but it doesn't shirk on any of the data points.
Yes. Well, thank you for saying that, because it was a tough balance to try to come up with, because I actually wanted to, you know, my initial impulse was to put in like even 10 times more data than that, because as a lawyer, I also, I love the facts. I want the evidence. I don't want someone to just assert something or just tell me anecdotes. I want to know, you know, what has the research shown? What is happening nationally? And so I made a big effort to include lots of factual data about public health issues that are implicated, about pollution issues, about just all kinds of issues that are related to animal food production. But at the same time, I tried, as you said, to keep it palatable and not to make it too much data, and also not to have it all in one big clump. So the data is kind of sprinkled throughout the book. But it's all very well documented. There are over 300 notes in the back of the book that tell where all the facts come from. And for those of us who really want to know that kind of stuff, it's all there. For anyone who wants to know, the data is there.
It seems to me that males in this, in any kind of food industry, don't fare very well. Do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, well, it does depend on the species, but definitely if in the sectors that are producing non-meat, non-flesh-based foods, so the egg production sector and the dairy production sector, the male animals are particularly unlucky, because if you're a dairy calf, if you're born to a dairy cow, and about 50% of the calves are male, they are essentially a byproduct of the dairy industry. They don't have anything use for them. A male dairy animal can never produce milk. So it has very, very little value. And there are times, it depends on the market fluctuations, but there are times when a male dairy calf is worth about $5. In contrast that with like a brand new female calf who would be worth over $100 immediately after birth. What's happened is with the baby chicks, the male chicks in the egg-laying sector, as well as the male calves in the dairy sector, there's a huge problem in dealing with those animals, and they have essentially become waste products of those industries. And with the male chicks, what is typically done is they're basically just killed immediately after birth. The male calves become, about a third of them become veal. About a third of them are, this probably varies from year to year, but I cite one specific year in the book and I talk about what happened in that year and gave this example. About a third of them are slaughtered for meat, but immediately after birth, so within about the first 3 days of their birth. Some of them will be raised for veal, so they'll be raised up a few months old, but unfortunately that's generally in a crate, a wooden crate. And so they really have very, very miserable lives. And the lucky few will actually get to go down a pathway that's not that great either, but it's better than those other two fates, and that is they will be raised up for meat. And so they will go to a feedlot You know, which is not a great way for a cattle animal to live, but it's better than the other two options. So that is actually, I agree with you, that's one of the most troubling things that I discuss in the book. And it's actually something that, you know, we have to grapple with as a society, I think, because we're just, it's just not responsible to you know, to basically kill 50% of the live births of your dairy animals or your egg breed chickens.
But my husband was talking about how when he was young, he, even at the age of our youngest daughter at 10, that he would help out on a cattle ranch. Actually, hang out has to be more like it than help out. And that the thing that really got to him, the branding didn't seem as if that was causing a lot of pain to the cows. I mean, it seemed like they would jump from it, but it just wasn't as gruesome. What got to him was the ear punching, and the castrations. Mm. Is that common practice on all ranches?
Well, I would say, to be honest, I'm going to disagree with him a little bit on some of that. I actually think that from having been involved with and observed and performed a lot of ear tagging myself, it's very similar to a human ear piercing experience. And if you do it properly you avoid the veins, you're going through essentially just a fleshy area and there's not even any bleeding or anything. I think it causes the animal very minimal amount of pain. It is certainly discomfort, but so is having one's ears pierced. You know, we all of us who have ears pierced know that. But it's something that, you know, it's relatively quickly gotten over. And I think that the benefit of that practice is extremely great, and that is that every animal is identified and traceable from birth all the way to slaughter, and it's a really important thing to do. So, to me, everything is always about why is the practice being done, and is it justified, and how much suffering is caused, and is that suffering necessary? So, like ear tagging, as one example, would be something that I would say causes fairly minimal suffering and has a very great purpose. So, I think it's a justifiable practice. Now, the branding question is a little different. I also feel that branding is justifiable because it has a very important purpose, and that is having an indelible mark on an animal, which, especially in the ranches in the western part of the United States, where they're on very large open range areas, and sometimes they're actually mixed with other herds out on the range, it's almost really the only way that you can keep track of your animals in a really secure way, and it prevents both inadvertent loss of animals as well as theft. But I actually talk specifically about branding in my book, Righteous Pork Chop, and I suggest that we really should be moving towards freeze branding, which is a technology that causes really no pain at all to the animal and is almost as good. So there are alternatives for some of these things. Castration, to go through that final issue you raised, is definitely something that causes the animal pain. I think it is something that it is important that male animals, both in, well, I'm going to talk specifically about cattle. Castration is also done with pigs, but talking about specifically with cattle, it's a really important thing to do because it dramatically diminishes the amount of aggression that exists between the male animals, as well as the aggression that they might show towards human handlers. And so it's a safer way to raise animals, and it keeps the animals in a situation, in terms of their own temperament and their own development, where they're much less likely to fight with one another. So as far as managing your animals well and taking good care of your animals, I think castration is important. However, we've been doing on our ranch for the last several years banding at a young age, which is done with dogs as well, mm-hmm. a lot of times. And there's some debate about banding versus castration, but my feeling is that it does cause them quite a bit less pain and is a justifiable practice.
When you were talking about the chicks and how now they're all incubated, and we've been thinking, I have an incubator, and we've been thinking to order some of the very fancy chicken eggs and to get some of the ones from our normal chicken ranch person. But I was thinking that maybe, you know, we could then with the next generation, allow them to procreate naturally, except that you can't have a rooster in the city. So maybe we could do a rent a rooster and have, you know, conjugal visits.
Absolutely. You just have to figure out when your hens are coming into lay, as they say. And we're actually dealing with this very issue on our own farm right now, because it's kind of the epilogue. It's after the book ends. At the very end of the book, I say, you know, we're thinking about doing some turkeys. And in fact, we started doing that. And that's been a big thing that we've been occupying ourselves with for these last 10 months. We're raising very old breed, heritage breed turkeys that are breeds that were developed in the late 1800s, early 20th century. And so they are breeds that are capable of doing all the things that turkeys should be able to do, but that modern industrial turkeys are not capable of doing. Modern industrial turkeys are barely able to walk by the time they reach maturity because their breasts are so, they've been bred to be so overdeveloped in the breast area. And they absolutely cannot fly or really run, and they're totally incapable of mating. So almost 100%, pretty much 100% of modern turkey production is done using artificial insemination. So we of course didn't want to get involved with any of that. We don't believe in raising any animals that can't take care of themselves and don't have healthy bodies naturally. And that's one of the things we really believe in, that's part of humane animal husbandry. So of course we had to go and get the very old breeds and go to one of the really good breeders in the country that was in Kansas that was doing that. And we did that. And so we're dealing with that very question now. You know, what do we do for the next generation? And what we've decided to do for this year, because we're on this very steep learning curve with this flock of turkeys, is we are having some of the eggs incubated, but we are also allowing some of the hens to raise their own, or to hatch their own and raise their own babies, and we'll see how it goes. It'll be, you know, one thing that's interesting is there's been so much loss of information from generation to generation among the animals themselves, and so none of these turkeys that we have right now, the turkey hens, were raised by their own mothers. They were all incubated, and so it's going to have to, we're hoping that because they're old breeds, they're still going to have really strong instincts intact. And between their instincts and probably a year or two is experience, you know, they'll start getting to be probably pretty good at hatching and pretty good at raising their babies. And so we're hoping to kind of begin reestablishing some of that knowledge within our flock.
I know that my chicken guy was having to teach his new chicks how to drink water.
Yeah.
You know, and so he was having to be the mother hen. So we're also really on this steep learning curve, you know, where we're trading different. My conversations this week were about the proper way to skin a rabbit, or, you know, the most humane way to slaughter a chicken. The term we've been using is dispatch. We think that that's not quite as euphemistic as harvest.
Right, exactly. I refuse to use the word harvest because it's too big of a euphemism. It's like you're denying what you're actually doing, and I don't believe in that.
Exactly. And so what we're working for is an honest relationship with our food. And I was interested to hear you also write about the dual-purpose cows that could be both dairy and meat, because I have had that question. You know, we're looking at starting a dairy co-op, and it would be nice to have ones that were dual purpose. I had mentioned during the presentation Andy Griffin, who owns two small farms and Marikita farms here, and his heirloom breeds, where he's going back to the ones that are smaller, are really about half the size of the cows now, and that can be finished on grass. And so those things are it's really interesting to me to find that people are doing those experiments.
Yes, I agree. And I think it's a very interesting thing with cattle that, you know, they've been, in this country especially, they've really been specialized over the last century to be either dairy cattle or beef cattle. And there are some good reasons why that has occurred, but it has these terrible side effects of, as I was talking about earlier, creating in the dairy breeds, for example, creating these young males that are essentially waste products. And and there's not that, unless in certain circumstances when the beef market is very, very strong, quite a few of those will get raised up for beef. But as a general matter, the dairy cattle males are not really worth anything, have no real value in the system when it's built like that. And the beauty, and I talk about this in my book, the beauty of having a breed that is more general purpose, which is more how nature would construct animals, that allows each animal to have some role in the food system and to be given a good life, a good opportunity to live a good life, and then at an appropriate age to be slaughtered for food, or if it's a female, to produce milk. And it won't produce as much milk as a specialized dairy cow if it's a female, and it might not produce the beef that's quite as optimal as a beef animal would, but it can produce very, very good quality beef. And so you have like the Devon and the Brown Swiss and some of these other cattle breeds that were raised in Europe and in the early United States for both meat and dairy, and we're very good in both categories. Mm-hmm. But then this obsession of specialization came into place in the 20th century. And so we find ourselves in the situation that we're in now. So I think it's wonderful, especially when smaller scale operations try to work with the dual purpose breeds. And I'm quite determined that when we get our own dairy cow, which is going to happen sometime in the next couple of years, we don't have any dairy animals on our farm right now, but it's going to be a breed that will be a dual purpose breed, because I would never want to have a dairy cow on our ranch and then have her have a male calf and us say, oh, well, that's just a worthless animal. Can't do anything with that. You know, we would want that animal to have the opportunity to grow and to graze on pasture and to live until maturity, and then it would be slaughtered for meat. And I would want that to be good meat. And so my feeling is we need to have a dual-purpose animal so that no matter which kind of offspring she has, it would be valuable to us and she can produce. The other thing is, if you're a smaller-scale producer, and especially if it's for your own consumption, it's actually better if you're not producing too much milk. So you're in a better situation if you have a cow that's producing a more reasonable amount of milk. You're not having to struggle with the excess. So it's actually a really logical thing to do if you're, especially operating on a smaller scale.
The whole system, since I've gotten into this backyard animal husbandry, which has been only since about Thanksgiving, it's wonderful. It really makes me feel so good because there is nothing that's wasted. I go to the farmer's market now, and they give me boxes of leftover vegetables for the rabbits. I take all my compost. It goes out to the chickens. I look in my backyard, and where you talk about, these, when I'm reading about the chickens in your book, and I'm looking at my chickens, who are spoiled brats. We have, for being in the middle of town, a big lot. It's like 1.5 lots, and they have the complete run of it. And it is not enough for them. They come and look in the back door, and they cock their eyes ever since we've blocked off the walkway so they can't get to the front yard.
Right.
So they are really living the dream right now. When we were talking after the show, many of us were talking about just how much we loved how nuanced you are, that things are just not black and white, that you see the practical side and that you don't come out with these strong moralistic statements. And so I just wanted to tell you how much we have been appreciating that.
Great. Thank you. Well, I think I really do view it that way. And I think that it was interesting, especially as I was writing the book, I was increasingly realizing that I didn't want to take any extreme stances on things. Not that my book isn't strong or clear or doesn't take positions on things, but I really do see multiple sides to many of these issues. And especially, I think one of the things that's given me that appreciation is that I started out working as an advocate and an activist and a proponent for reform, But I learned more and more about the issue as I went through it, and I didn't in any way lose my passion for reform, but I began to understand the many angles and facets of the issues. And I think especially these past 6 years, when I have been doing animal husbandry myself every single day, it's given me a much greater appreciation and understanding for what farmers and ranchers are facing. For example, your question earlier about the various different practices like ear tagging and castration, I might have thought when I first started all this work that I was opposed to those practices. And then over time, having been to many farms and ranches and understanding why those practices take place and what benefits they have and the necessity for them, I've come more to the position of feeling that they're acceptable if done properly. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of having had lots of different types of experiences with animal farming has given me a lot of the appreciation for the nuances that I agree are definitely there.
But while you are not judgmental, there are many vegetarians, and we experienced, I think, one tonight,
right.
Who look right. at it and who say, well, you know, why don't you just, you know, turn away altogether? Isn't that the ethical thing to do? And so because, to use a pun, I think we carnivores are cowed by the holier-than-thou vegetarian, I'd like to make a case for meat-eating as being a more ethical way of living than being a vegetarian. Just to throw it out. What I study a lot are the human effects of raising, of how we eat. The immigrant population that we are fully dependent on, the trade policies that have subsidized grains and have wrecked the economies and have at this point imposed a global food crisis. If I were to choose your next field, I would love to see you tackle the raising of vegetables and how labor intensive it is. That our baby, mm-hmm. what I've heard from the farmers that I talk to, that those cute little baby lettuces that we eat require tilling it, you know, like three times in order to keep that size. Mm-hmm. And so what I wonder is, would it be possible to sustain ourselves as vegetarians if we did not have fossil fuels, mm-hmm. and if we did not have access to a global slave labor force, if we mm-hmm. hadn't created that? Because when I look at, like, eating in winter, it just mm-hmm. seems like it's a beautiful system that it calls for things like beans and stews and all those canned vegetables, and that the fats in animals, I've become a proponent of that. I'm pro lard. When I cook chicken, I cook with schmaltz, which is mm-hmm. actually what chicken fat is called. Mm-hmm. Schmaltz is chicken fat, mm-hmm. and so it's just very efficient. I haven't gone whole hog, mm-hmm. but I have gone whole chicken, mm-hmm. and only using, like, especially the Atkins diet. I think that if we are ever on trial for what we have done to the rest of the world, that the Atkins diet will be a key use in prosecuting us, because it is this princess mentality. Yeah. I deserve the choicest piece, and the rest of it should be wasted. Yeah. I am that boneless, skinless chicken breast mentality just seems so wasteful to me.
Yeah,
you know, and eating in community, food preferences. I think that we have been bred to be consumers, mm-hmm. and that in our feedlot performance, our pecking order is determined by how picky we are. And so everyone has these food preferences, which frankly has taken the fun out of dinner parties or feeding people. And right. don't even get me started on kids. I won't have other people's kids over anymore around mealtimes, mm-hmm. because it just has become, and so at a spiritual level, it feels to me ungrateful. It feels to me like refusing the gift, that it's just such a beautiful system, and that to refuse the gift feels wrong.
Well, first of all, bravo. That was a beautiful speech, and I agree with just about everything you just said. You'll be interested to know that I've actually got an essay sitting in the New York Times op-ed hopper. I've had three op-eds in the New York Times, and there's a fourth one that they've accepted, but they haven't published. But they've been sitting on it for a long time, so I'm starting to worry they're never going to run it. But it's actually about the question of global warming and animal production as a part of that, because there's a huge amount of sort of information out there, or people stating or suggesting, and the media being a big part of this, that the global warming problem is largely a result of animal farming. And that's really such an oversimplification and a very misshapen message when one really looks at the facts and the data and really understands agriculture. And what my op-ed argues is, and this is just a little piece of what you were talking about, but that good animal farming is actually beneficial to the environment, including the global warming issue, and that there's not a lot of good animal farming happening now, but that isn't inherent in animal farming. It's not intrinsic in animal farming that it would be a major contributor to global warming. It's just our current system that is doing that, and that's a huge distinction. And so I also agree that I'm really not a proponent of any one group or person saying that their diet is the most righteous or ethical. But I certainly do disagree with the notion that a vegetarian or a vegan can take a moral high ground. And when you really start talking with most vegans or vegetarians, I have found that a lot of the food that they're purchasing or consuming is often some of the most resource-intensive foods. And many vegetarians do not know that the greatest cause of deforestation in Brazil for the last decade has been soy production. And it's true that a lot of that soy goes to livestock, but a lot of that soy also goes into human foods. And in fact, the Organic Consumers Association a few years ago was publishing information about how, you know, the soy milk and the tofu being sold organic soy in Whole Foods markets and other stores around the United States was coming from those very rainforested areas that had been cut down to produce soy fields. So the notion that you can just convert to vegetarianism and all of a sudden you're eating some kind of an ethical diet or something that gives you a moral high ground is just false. And I also agree with what you said about waste. I'm passionately opposed to waste. And there's been a lot of good, very, very good writing for the last couple of decades by people like Wendell Berry and Wes Jackson and other experts in agriculture and philosophy that have pointed out that the least wasteful and the best, ecologically speaking, kind of farming is farming that is a blend of animal and plant farming. And when you're just raising plants in isolation without animals, you cannot use... You're not mimicking nature as well as you should be, because what nature does is nature is all about animals and plants all working together, and bacteria and all kinds of, you know, microscopic creatures, and all of them having their role and their niche in the ecosystem. And really, really good farming is mimicking that. And if you're just raising foods that are just for vegetarians, you're losing a whole opportunity to have a really ecologically based farming system. And I just finished reading a book by Wendell Berry called The Unsettling of America, where he talks very specifically about the disdain that we've had in this country for many years for hand labor, for doing things that, you know, without technology or machinery, and how wrong-minded that is. And I totally agree with that. And living out on a farm, as I have for the past 6 years, it's an amazing thing, because all of a sudden you're having to do things for yourself that, you know, you wouldn't have thought of knowing how to do, or trying to learn how to do things like splitting wood and just about anything, fixing a fence or a water leak, or, you know, just you have to have daily skills every day to grapple with the things that we require to live our lives, to get our water, to get our food, to heat your home, to keep the roof from leaking, etc. And it's been the most gratifying experience to be learning all those things.
Thank you so much, Nicolette. It's been Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, author of Righteous Pork Chop.